Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Welcome to the Freedom Report. First, a message from our sponsors. The Libertarian Republic is brought to you in part by Amagi Metals. Amagi Metals is TLR's trusted metals dealer, and their mission is to help simplify the buying process of metals while illuminating the importance of financial responsibility and sound money. So, if you've been thinking about getting into metals, go to amagimetals.com and check them out. That's amagimetals.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report. This is your host, Austin Peterson. I'm here with a very special guest. This is John Lott. He's a gun rights advocate. He's the author of the book, More Guns, Less Crime. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me here. I guess I'd rather be called a scholar or something.
A scholar.
rights advocate. I mean, you look at the data and you see what it has to say. I know my views have changed a fair amount over time. If you research comes out a certain way, pretty much people pigeonhole you as being one way or the other, but I like to think I'm driven by the data.
Now, some of the most controversial legislation that was recently passed comes out of Connecticut, where there was basically a moratorium on assault rifles, where it's a registry, basically. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening in Connecticut and the people who were lining up to, who didn't line up to register their assault rifles, could they have their guns confiscated?
Yeah, sure. And one of the things I'm sure a lot of people are concerned about is once you register guns, that registry can be used to confiscate guns at a later date. I mean, they just have to look at what's happened in New York City the last couple months. They've had confiscation of guns that were recently registered there. And surely places from Chicago to California and, of course, around the world, registries have been used to confiscate guns. You know, I mean, that's often a first step. Mm-hmm. I mean, the notion behind registration is that it can be used to help solve crime. Problem is that it's never successful in doing that. You know, in theory, if you register a gun and it's used in a crime and the gun's left at the crime scene, then you can go and trace it back to the person that owned it, hopefully presuming they're the ones who committed the crime. But there are a couple problems with that. One is, crime guns are very rarely left at the crime scene. In the few cases the crime guns are left there, it's usually because the criminal has been either killed or seriously wounded, so you're going to catch them anyway. And in the few times they're left there, and you have a situation where they're usually not registered. And in the couple cases where they're registered, they're not registered to the person that committed the crime. So it's like, you spend a huge amount of money. I know it testified in Hawaii in 2000 about their registration system. They were planning on changing at the time. And one of the state legislators, I got to go and ask the police chief for Honolulu a question. He said, how many hours of police time do you spend going and dealing with the registration system? And he estimated conservatively it was at least 50,000 hours of police time each year was just spent on registering guns. That's a lot of time. And the cost of the registration system is that those police could have been used to go and do things that we know that work with regard to crime. And so it's, you have to balance. You say, well, how many crimes can we solve as a result of registration? Looks like zero. You know, Hawaii, they couldn't point to any. It's kind of an ideal experiment. You have an island nation there. But we have registration in other places, Chicago, Washington, D.C., New York won't release any numbers, so you can't tell, but Chicago and Washington, D.C., they haven't been able to point to any crimes that have been solved as a result of registration. And so, you know, on the one hand, it doesn't seem like there's any benefits. On the other hand, there are real costs that are involved, and they're costs not just to the police having to waste their time, but costs to civilians. My own belief is that the reason why they push registration, just make it costly and difficult for people to own guns and just try to discourage gun ownership. Just make it risky and make it so that at a later date they can go and confiscate the guns. The thing in Connecticut, though, that's happening right now is they're not having a lot of people kind of register their guns. But that's often something that you see with registrations.
One of the things I'd like to ask you about is Obama has threatened to use executive actions, executive orders, when it comes to guns. Do you fear that in the last couple of years of his presidency that Obama will take drastic action in regards to gun control with executive orders?
Well, I'm sure he'll take some. I think with regard to drastic things that he's going to do, I'm most concerned about who he's appointing on the courts. Mm-hmm. You look at the decisions that struck down D.C. or Chicago's gun control laws, those were decided by 5-4 votes, very close margins that were there. Two of those five votes in the bare majority were by Kennedy and Scalia, who are going to be over 80 years of age by the end of the Obama administration. Particularly if Democrats win the presidency next time around, it's going to be really bad because there's no way they're going to make it to their mid to late 80s, both of them. And so you lose one of those guys, you're going to have really dramatic changes. And with regard to appeals courts and circuit courts, Obama has already appointed more federal judges than any other president in modern history. And he's going to have a huge majority. And the thing is, with the loss of the filibuster in the Senate, that he's appointing ever more and more radical people to be on the courts. And so, I mean, it's just not going to be in terms of guns, but it's across the board. But
I'd like to talk about culture in general, because one of the things that we're starting to see, the trends that we're starting to see across the United States, are young people who are getting in trouble. They're getting suspended from school for doing things like pointing their finger in the shape of a gun. Police officers are shooting young people who have airsoft guns, replica guns, and killing them because there seems to be a generalized fear, a growing fear of guns. Do you think that gun culture, America's gun culture, is starting to be turned on its head?
Well, I think one of the reasons why they have these crazy zero tolerance things, which are just nutty, as you say. You have people get in trouble because they draw a picture of their brother who's a soldier in the military or something like that. Or a kid bites into a Pop-Tart and some teacher thinks that it looks like a gun and the kid didn't even have that on his mind. It's just they bit into it at an angle and it made it look like
a gun,
at least to the teacher's mind. I think it's just a way of traumatizing kids with regard to guns. There's no reason why they couldn't have some type of rational basis of whether there's a real threat or not. If somebody has a half-inch toy thing on their keychain or something, how is that a threat? How is that going to be used as a weapon to scare people? Mm-hmm. Even that looks like a gun. And so I think it's just a way of liberals who control schools just trying to traumatize people.
So how do you try and change that kind of a culture when you have even, police officers complicit in doing things like gun buybacks, for example?
Well, look, police officers are, if you go to crimepreventionresearch.org, which is my organization, I have information on surveys of police officers, for example. Police are probably the strongest group in this country in favor of gun ownership by private individuals. Mm-hmm. You look at surveys, Police One, which is the largest organization of police officers in the United States, they're about 45,000 members, about 80,000 of them are retired, but the rest are active duty. You go through the questions there and you'll have 77% think armed civilians are either extremely or very important in terms of reducing crime. If you go and you
ask... The Detroit police chief came out in the last 6 months or so saying that, it'd be better if more citizens were armed.
Yeah, no, but the thing that's great that he does that, and particularly for a heavily Democratic city, it's risky for a police chief who's at the discretion of the mayor or the city council to say that. But the thing is that his views are quite common. You look at the National Association of Chiefs of Police, and you have 77, which is the largest organization of police chiefs. They have like 2,500 members. 77% of them believe that would rather have not very restrictive concealed carry laws. You know, they just think once you basically apply and you pass a criminal background check and you pay your fee, you should be able to go and get a permit, and they think you should be able to carry it any place in the country once you get it, kind of like your driver's license and driving. But, you know, I think it's good that he got attention, and it's good that he's black, because my own research indicates that poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas are the ones who benefit the most. They're the most likely to be victims of violent crime, and so they benefit the most from having the option to go and defend themselves. Yeah, so I think it's particularly important for somebody such as himself, who's kind of an authority figure, to come out and say the types of things. But he's not the only one. You have David Clark, the sheriff from Milwaukee and Wisconsin, and others who have done the same thing. So
that brings me to the last topic that I'd like to discuss, which is the Stand Your Ground laws. Now, some people have been writing articles, you know, obviously from left-wing publications, that Stand Your Ground is racist and that it's basically a way for, you know, white people to have an excuse to shoot unarmed black people if they feel like they're threatened. Do you think that that's untrue? Do you think that blacks can benefit from Stand Your Ground laws?
I think blacks are the ones who benefit the most. Again, you can go to crimepreventionresearchcenter.org. But look, blacks are the most likely victims of violent crime. They're the ones who benefit the most from having the option to be able to go and defend themselves. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the data, blacks are much more likely to avail themselves of the Stand Your Ground defense than whites are. And they're more successful when they raise it than whites are. So, you know, you have a situation where you have a couple of anecdotal cases and people ignore who the real victims of violent crime are in this country. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to say, it's really sad. I mean, Democrats generally paint themselves as caring about poor people and minorities. But look at the types of laws that they pass. They pass these laws that require high fees, licensing arrangements. In Washington, D.C., which we're right next door to here, to get a license and register a handgun costs, according to the Washington Post, $534. Who do you think is able to pay $534? It's not the people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime. It's not poor blacks who live in the district. It's basically wealthy whites. In Illinois, they finally were forced to have a concealed carry law that's just the first permits are going out. But it costs about $700 to go through the licensing and registration process. Who do you think is going to get permits with $700? Or in Maryland, next door here, may actually be in Maryland right now. They just passed licensing and registration for handguns here in the state, and it costs like $350 to license and register a handgun. It's a systematic push just to try to make it costly for people to own guns. So, but you know, again, you can go through and crimepreventionresearchcenter.org, and you can get much more detail on Stand Your Ground or these other types of fees.
Okay, there's actually one more topic then you brought up that I want to hit on before we go. I've heard that Beretta Firearms is possibly going to be leaving Maryland, and also there was another firearms manufacturer that was going to be leaving Connecticut, I believe. There was another major firearms manufacturer. Their name escapes me at the moment. But what do you think about this trend of gun companies that are fleeing the northern states for places like Louisiana, you know?
Or Texas. Or
Texas, yeah.
Well, you know, I guess I'm not surprised. I don't really have a lot to say about it, but I can understand why they move or from Illinois or other places. Mm-hmm. You know, given the high taxes and other things that often occur in those types of states too, they probably have other reasons to want to move besides just the hostile climate with regard to regulations.
Gotcha. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening. John, thank you very much for joining the podcast. This is John Mott. He's a gun scholar and author of More Guns, Less Crime. John, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you very much.